Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. During various cycles of public health news, we often hear from or see the Surgeon General of the United States. We often see him or her dressed in Navy-type blues or whites, which look like military uniforms. Well, the Surgeon General is a physician or nurse appointed by the executive branch of the U.S. government, and they have to be approved by the Senate. But as with many government agencies, the vast majority of its employees are civil servants. Have you ever wondered why the Surgeon General and the rank and file, the commission corps of the U.S. Public Health Service, wear these uniforms? I know I have. After all, though one focus of the commission corps is to respond to health emergencies, they are not a branch of the military. The U.S. Public Health Service actually started all the way back in 1870, and over its century plus of existence, it's been involved in heroic efforts like fighting Ebola in Africa, for which the corps was honored with a presidential citation. But the Corps is just as infamous for its involvement in the so-called Tuskegee syphilis study, which started in 1932 and followed African-American men in the South infected with syphilis who remained untreated even after the commercialization of penicillin, which to this day is still curative for the disease. And that study went on for 40 years until it was exposed by a crusading journalist. My guest today is Dr. Karen Landman, a writer and physician based in Atlanta, who's just written a brilliant article on the history and direction of the U.S. Public Health Service for the online science magazine UnDark. Landman is an infectious disease specialist and has written for news sources including The Atlantic, Wired, Vice News, Stat, the Columbia Journalism Review, and NPR, among many others. Landman served in the Public Health Service from 2012 through 2014. She was stationed at the CDC, where she worked as an epidemic intelligence officer. Karen Landman is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Karen Landman, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by just having you tell us about the U.S. Public Health Service and what led you to write this article in UnDark, this online science magazine.
I was in the Corps, which is one of the seven uniformed services of the United States, between 2012 and 2014. And I joined because when I began a fellowship at CDC called EIS, the Epidemic Intelligence Service, you could get hired as a civilian, like most people who get hired into government jobs. But there was also an option of being hired as a member of the commission corps. And the difference in pay and benefits was substantial. I think for my particular station, there was probably a $10,000 or $20,000 advantage in pay if you joined as a member of the corps. Plus, you got a lot of good benefits. Like free health care and the GI Bill. And so I joined as a member of the Corps. People told me when I joined, yeah, technically it's a uniformed service, but it's so much lower key than, say, the Army or the Marines. You know, there's not really much adherence to physical standards. So you just didn't have to do a lot of the things with quite the level of standardization that you did in the other services. So I said, oh, that's that sounds fine. I'm not a person who really likes having to conform to a whole lot of rules like that. So I thought the exchange was probably worth it. So I did my 2 years at CDC, and I was a core member the entire time. And then when I came to the end of that time, I kind of needed a break from the sort of treadmill that I felt like I was on. So I left CDC and also decommissioned from the core. But even before that, I felt like I was probably not a great fit for it because I knew some people who really did respect the rules and were pretty dismayed by people like me who sort of felt they were optional. And I felt myself that, you know, if I'm part of a group and these are their rules and this is sort of the exchange, you know, I follow the rules and that's why I get the better pay. You know, I don't. It's not really a marker of my integrity for me to stay in a group like this. I'm not really doing what's required to get the pay, so I shouldn't be part of it. And then, you know, after I left, I still had and still do have lots of friends in the Corps, and I started to ask myself why it was even really an option for people to treat these rules as optional to begin with. And in addition to that, while I was in the Corps, I noticed some things sort of administratively that seemed just very arbitrary, the enforcement of certain rules, the way certain operations took place sort of administratively seemed really uneven. And so I really started to wonder why it was run the way it was, why its members felt like they could, you know, take the option of not following the rules, and also why, you know, whether we really even needed it to exist as it did, because I didn't see us doing things that were very different from our civilian counterparts. When the federal government released their plan to drastically reduce the Corps' budget and membership last June, I heard a lot of outcry coming from my friends in the Corps, and I thought, now's the time for me to really look into this.
So it's kind of, I mean, a retrospective in a way, having been in the Corps. But so when we think, I think when I say we, civilians, people who aren't in the Public Health Service, we're always going to think of the Surgeon General in his or her uniform, right? And so, but that's right. Definitely one of the issues which you alluded to is this thing about uniforms. And the article really addresses that point. So, for example, one of the most famous Surgeon Generals was C. Everett Koop in the 1980s. And I learned this from your article. He was pretty strict and came down pretty hard on wanting a Public Health Service Corps members to wear their uniforms, but he was met with pretty strong backlash. Can you talk a little bit about that?
During the time of Vietnam, there was sort of an increase in membership in the Corps that some people attributed to trying to avoid being sent to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. This was among people who were qualified to join the Corps. You know, they had a public health background. But the way that played out in the 1970s was that they didn't want to be wearing a uniform. And so there were certain, you know, there was some variation among the Corps. There were people who had joined, you know, from a different perspective and had not really joined in order to dodge a draft. But there were those who had joined specifically to avoid being drafted into a uniformed military, sort of an armed service. So you had a lot of variability during the 1970s of uniform wear sort of tied to that perspective. So when Koop became Surgeon General in the 1980s, I think he felt that this really was a key problem in the Corps' esprit de corps. And over the course of the 1980s, I think it took him a few years to get to the point where he felt he could issue this directive that everybody should be wearing their uniforms at all times, that it wasn't elective. Before that, I think it had been sort of tradition. I'm not sure if it was actually codified anywhere, but it was sort of tradition for officers to wear their uniforms once a week. And he said, no, you need to wear them all the time. And there was such a huge uproar that he had to back down and say, okay, we're going to allow you to wear uniforms just once a week. And each federal agency can decide which day of the week that is. So I think the NIH had chosen, I don't remember whether it was Tuesday or Wednesday, and then CDC chose a different day. So a lot of folks I spoke with who had been in the Corps now for a couple of decades say that, you know, by the time they joined the Corps in the late 80s, early 90s, they wore their uniform once a week, if at all.
Well, one of the great things about your piece is that you go really into the history of the Commissioned Corps. And so things that I didn't realize, for example, it started way back in 1870. So tell us a little bit about the early history of the Commissioned Corps and then what some of the challenges have been sort of over the decades. But, I mean, it's been a real public health leader in many respects, but it seems as though, you know, your impetus for writing this article was, sort of once again it may be on the chopping block because this sort of seems to happen periodically throughout eras in our medical and national history.
Yeah, so the Corps was created to do something really, really different than it does today. It was created to serve these Marine hospitals that were kind of in varying places along the coastline and that had been established to care for sick and disabled seamen. Those hospitals, by the time the Corps got to them in the late 1800s, they were 100 years old. A lot of them were crumbling, and so they needed a lot of help. So these folks were put into uniform and deployed the way all uniformed services are thought to be deployed. Certainly the armed services are deployed today. They were sent for periods of time to care for people in these hospitals. And then this was happening at the same time that there were all of these developments in understanding bacteriology and understanding the spread of diseases were happening throughout Europe. And as the need to treat outbreaks of infectious diseases developed over the latter part of the 19th century, earlier part of the 20th century, the Corps seemed like the natural resource for the federal government to use in order to deal with those problems. So they were deployed to deal with typhoid outbreaks, to deal with patients at leprosy hospitals, and to deal with all kinds of other outbreaks and collect surveillance data when outbreaks were not taking place all over the country. Again, they were deployed to do this in uniform. So when the time came to actually how to integrate them into the military. This is sort of just following or just near the end of World War II. There was a lot of debate over how to assign them benefits. There was one senator who said they were kind of neither fish nor fowl. They're neither really military, because even though they were deployed alongside members of the armed forces, they were functioning as healthcare providers, usually, to them, to those armed forces. So it was unclear whether they should be treated from a benefit standpoint as civilians or as uniformed services.
I learned from your article there's a ton of pushback from the military branches about the commissioned corps wearing uniforms. Like, there's sort of a sense that, hey, you guys aren't soldiers, you don't really belong in these uniforms, or it sort of makes a mockery of us wearing the uniform. I mean, it seemed like there was quite a bit of that.
Yeah. I'm not sure, honestly, that I can trace back exactly when that started, but it certainly did seem to begin happening at that time. And I think what helped sort of crystallize that was in the time after the 1940s, the Corps was trying to define what it actually did. And it seemed there was this great debate over whether the country should nationalize health insurance. And the Corps seemed, again, like a natural organization to involve in nationalizing health care, because they had been providing health care, for example, to Native Americans on Native American reservations through IHS. But the leader of the Corps at that time did not want them to become embroiled in that discussion. They did not want the organization to be politicized in the way that the conversation around a national health service or a national health care service was being politicized. So kept them out of that conversation. Some might think now that actually weakened the Corps by sort of refusing to take on some of the difficult issues and to sort of beef up its membership in order to meet that challenge. And I think it may have actually weakened them by giving them less responsibility, where prior to that, they had really taken on all challenges that came their way.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Chu, and my guest today is Karen Landman, who is a writer and physician specializing in infectious diseases and public health. And Dr. Landman has written a really interesting article in UNDARC, which is at undarc.org. And it's about the United States Public Health Service, kind of the history of it and some of the political issues around it, the Commissioned Corps, as it's also known. And Dr. Landman, you were in the Commissioned Corps for about 3 years. Now, how does it work, like, when you get a deployment, so to speak? Like, were you sent to work at the CDC, or was that by your choice, or was it a combination of both?
Being commissioned into the Corps is a little different than being commissioned into another uniformed service. To join the Corps, you find a job first, what's called a billet, and then you apply both to that job and to the Commissioned Corps to fill that billet. And if you are commissioned, then you work for the agency that is employing you under that billet. For in my case, it was CDC, but you are simultaneously a member of the Corps. So you literally answer to two masters. You have your bosses at your agency and your Commissioned Corps headquarters that you answer to as well. So I joined, when I joined EIS, you could join, like I said, as a civilian or as a Corps member. And I chose to join as a member of the Corps.
Remind us what EIS stands for.
Yes, EIS is the Epidemic Intelligence Service. If you've seen the movie Contagion, Kate Winslet plays the role of an EIS officer. It's basically a training program to teach people field epidemiology.
Another fascinating aspect of this article is that there was, I don't know if it was the CDC, I can't remember, or one of the government agencies was looking for volunteers to go to West Africa back when the Ebola crisis was in its most flourishing stage. It was sort of dominating the news. And you quoted someone as saying that there were like 5,000 Commissioned Corps volunteers almost right away, and only a few hundred were needed. And so, you know, what do you attribute that to? And I mean, is that just the nature of folks who sign up for the Commissioned Corps, that they're gung-ho to kind of get into some of the most thorny public health issues?
It's a complicated answer, because different people I spoke to about the process of recruiting officers to deploy to the Ebola outbreak response, different people gave me different answers to the ease of recruiting people. Certainly the public discussion of deploying the Corps to that particular outbreak, all makes it sound like it was a piece of cake to get people to volunteer for this. And again, notice that when we talk about deploying, we're talking about people volunteering for deployment. This is not the way any of the armed services work. When various members of the U.S. Armed Forces went to go stand up hospitals, to field hospitals to take care of Ebola-infected individuals, they were sent. They were not asked. The Commission Corps sent out an email to its members and asked who might be interested in volunteering for this. So, again, everything said publicly about this and comments that the former acting Surgeon General Boris Lushnyak said to me said that it was very easy to get people to volunteer to go. I spoke with other sources off the record who are very familiar with this response who said it was really difficult to get people to volunteer. There were good reasons for that. It was a very frightening thing to deploy to. Ebola is very infectious. There was a lot of fear of becoming infected and not having access to good care. And there was also a lot of fear of what might happen if you came back, even if you weren't infected, because of what several legislators were doing by quarantining returning healthcare providers. So there was some hesitancy, according to this source, on the part of Commission Corps officers to volunteer for this.
Well, the article goes into some detail about it, and so I guess I didn't really realize there was this whole effort, and it was named the Monrovia Medical Unit, referring to the capital of Liberia, MMU. And there's this great photograph of President Obama in the Oval Office giving a presidential citation to the Commission Corps members who participated in the Ebola containment efforts. And then, you just fast forward a few years, and President Trump has a whole reform plan for the Commission Corps that wants to make it more leaner and efficient. I don't know, what's your read on that plan?
So, I think those two things are not incompatible. What the Corps felt it was really showing off during the Ebola outbreak was its clinical expertise and ability to quickly bring a high level of clinical expertise into a place that desperately needed it in an outbreak setting. And they did some of that. They did mobilize hundreds of well-trained clinicians into Liberia, and they stood up this ICU level of care field hospital and did provide care for some people. What I think the Trump administration has tried to express is that's all the Corps should be doing, is focusing on providing health care to people who desperately need it, whether in an outbreak setting or on the fringes socially here, and by which I mean geographically and socially. So the OMB's proposal really was to trim the core of the people who are not doing healthcare day to day, meaning people like me who were doing a lot of epidemiology work while at CDC, but most of that was either in front of a desk or in a study setting. So I wasn't actually providing care to people, but I was still a member of the core. What the administration wants to do is trim people like that, people who have, for lack of a better way to term it, have desk jobs rather than clinical jobs, trim those people out of the Corps so that what's left are people who are really clinicians at heart and in their day job, people who are working as doctors, as nurses, as pharmacists, as physical therapists, and in other clinical capacities day to day. So the problem with that, though, is that the people who do that for their day jobs are desperately needed at their day jobs. There are folks who are working at IHS who have incredibly understaffed healthcare centers where they work and would under no circumstances be allowed by their supervisor to leave their postings to go work for 2 weeks, at the border or at something like an Ebola outbreak again. So there needs to be more than just a reframing of the Corps' mission. There needs to be some resource devoted to supporting the ability to surge clinically into places where the Corps is needed, if we want to really see the Corps as a easily mobilizable, clinically expert service.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Karen Landman, who is a writer and physician specializing in infectious diseases and in public health, and spent a period of 2 years working as a Commission Corps officer in the U.S. Public Health Service, where she worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. and is currently a physician in Atlanta, not with the CDC any longer, but mostly a writer. And Karen, I wanted to harken back to something you said IHS, so Indian Health Service. So how much of a role does the Public Health Service or the Commissioned Corps play in the Indian Health Service? Like, do you have a sense of that? Is it crucial to the successful operation of IHS to have the Commissioned Corps available?
Yes. I spoke with Mary Smith, who was the head of IHS Indian Health Service briefly during the tail end of the Obama administration. And she told me that the expertise and personnel that the Corps provides is critical to the functioning of IHS. IHS currently employs around 15,000 people. It's unclear to me how many of those are physicians, how many are nurses, so sort of how, you know, what the personnel breakdown is of that. I will say among those 15,000 employees, almost 1,900 of them are Corps, are members of the Commissioned Corps. So that is a pretty substantial proportion of IHS personnel as a whole. So it's a mechanism by which IHS can hire people who are committing to a longer period of service than a civilian might. You know, there are benefits that the Corps offers that are tied to long-term service. So if you join the Corps and you stay for 20 years, you get a really good pension benefit. So they're kind of incentivized to stay in the Corps and continue to do some kind of service on a national level for a long time once they join. So this is to the great benefit of IHS, which, as I mentioned, is chronically understaffed. I spoke with a Corps member in IHS off the record who told me that they'd been able to move around to several positions within IHS as a member of the Corps in a way that had been really beneficial for their professional development and also compatible with their interest in serving the underserved. So I think a lot of people probably are similar to this person. They really wanted to provide care to people sort of in the margins, and the IHS and the Corps sort of working together provided them a great way to do that. If the Corps were to go away completely, you know, Mary Smith and several others have told me the IHS would have a lot of trouble hiring and filling their positions even more than they do today. Which could have a huge impact on the health of Americans living on reservation.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to show that it does play a vital function in staffing Indian Health Service. So any attempt to have a major reorganization on the Commissioned Corps could have, you know, a detrimental effect on IHS. I mean, I guess I wonder under that OMB, that Office of Management and Budget plan to kind of reform the Commissioned Corps, I was wondering if... You talk about the plan calling for the elimination of all those desk jobs in the Commissioned Corps. I mean, where would those functions take place, or is that more of the sort of overall deconstruction of the administrative state? Those jobs would just go away? I mean, we only need the clinicians. Is that kind of the theory, or would they just be under some other executive branch or some other agency?
So what OMB seems to propose is that they would just be civilianized. They would just be made regular government jobs. It really oversimplifies how people function during deployment to advocate civilianizing non-clinical people in the Corps. You're basically spending a lot more when you deploy a civilian to one of these outbreaks than when you deploy a Corps member. The IHS doctor that I spoke with mentioned, he told me a story about coming back from vacation to a phone call overnight from the hospital where he was working, that there was a baby in extremis that needed immediate care. And so he got back from his vacation and in the middle of the night went to the hospital to care for this baby. And it was, I think it was snowing there. I don't remember the story exactly. But if he had been a civilian, he probably wouldn't have even received a call because technically his day would not have started until 9 a.m. the following morning. But because he was poor, they could call him at any time, and he would have to go in. Now, he's somebody for whom a sense of duty is very strong, so this wasn't a complaint. But I think you have to understand that when people serve as Corps members, many of them really feel bound to a higher sense of duty than civilian government workers. And that's something that is mentioned in one of the assessments that I quote in the article, that when you hire people within the framework of national service, the way the Corps does, you get different people than when you hire civilians. And you get people who sometimes really feel committed to a sense of country, a sense of duty, and who just work differently and may work a little more, a little harder than people not in uniform. Now, you can definitely dispute that, both by saying that there are people who are civilians who are extraordinarily committed to their work, and that there are people in uniform who are not particularly committed to that sense of duty in country. And I think you're not wrong. Nobody would be wrong to make that argument. But the fact still remains that there is a group of people in the Corps who feel very duty-bound by their uniform, and that we gain something by continuing to keep those people in uniform.
Yeah, I mean, it really is an interesting story, and I commend you on the research. Karen, I want to shift gears for a second, talk a little bit about your writing. So you're a physician in practice, but you also, it seems like, do a lot of writing, and as I understand, some radio, too. You are based in Atlanta and have done some work with, is it the Georgia Tech public radio station down there?
That's right, WREK. I am one of the three hosts of their only interview program called North Avenue Lounge.
And tell us a little bit about the show. Like, what kinds of things do you focus on, or is it just kind of current events?
Yeah, I'm interested in, I guess you could call it vaguely health-related and science-related things happening on the local scene here in Atlanta. We have a lot of really exciting and really interesting people doing innovative things here. I recently spoke with a doctor who teaches other physicians and healthcare providers to meditate. I've spoken with a local pastor who is an ambassador for an organization called the Black Church in HIV, which advocates for Black churches to take a leadership role in reducing the impact of HIV on Black communities. I spoke with the leaders of a group called the Squirrel Census, which has counted squirrels in an Atlanta neighborhood and most recently in New York City Central Park. And that was really a lot of fun to speak with them. Spoke with
any noticeable trends in the squirrel population?
I think squirrel population was pretty stable in the two censuses they've done in the same Atlanta neighborhood. I believe their final count for New York City Central Park was 2,373. They are a remarkable group. I would urge you to look them up. It's at thesquirrelcensus.com. They've done some really interesting work. Yeah. So I talk to people who do interesting things in Atlanta, and I guess it all sort of ties in with a lot of my interests in general in science and the public interest, healthcare disparities, and I guess sort of a general appreciation for quirk.
For quirk. Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and I just do want to give a shout-out to UnDark, who published this piece. They were very generous in giving me the opportunity to write it.
And the title of the piece is called For America's Uniform Public Health Service, Existential Questions Abound, and it's by my guest today, Dr. Karen Landman. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.